Hello and welcome along to the New Music Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Adam Tinian and I'm here today with a wonderful guest today. I'm so happy you've come along. Thank you so much, Steve Bolton.
Hi there, Adam. How are you doing?
Wonderful, wonderful. So, I mean, I just can't wait to delve into your career as a musician, some of the stories. And obviously, I've known you recently through Dead Man's Corner, which is the band that you currently front, that came in for a session. Actually, today, the day that we're recording, this is going to go out in a couple of weeks, but the day that we're recording was one of your tracks went out. So kind of good timing there.
Well, it's really... it's a funny thing that everything in my life seems to be leading up to this point.
Right.
So Dead Man's Corner, obviously, is my main thing at the moment.
Yeah.
And it seems like my whole life has been careering towards this moment of releasing that. But anyway.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, I must say, actually, I've heard really good things, you know, because I'm on social media all the time. And so I see random polls and the best band or best performance you saw last year. And a lot of people say Dead Man's Corner that have caught your gig. So, you know, you're kind of doing a really cool thing, I think. People are
and
really
I'm actually astounded because these clips you put up on the Seaside Sessions, you know, so now up to 3K, which to me is quite...
It's been great, isn't
quite
it?
Quite something,
Yeah, it's wonderful, definitely.
How did that happen? Have you been fiddling the books?
I've got the cheat codes for the Facebook, yeah. So, listeners, I'm sure as you're aware by now, this is episode number 11. We're going to jump straight into the first track. Steve's brought four to us today. And then we're going to delve into your career as a musician and things that you've done. And so first of all, I want to talk about The Weatherman.
Yes.
My personal favourite from the session that you did with us.
Yeah.
I just think it's a wonderful sound. It just
thank
fantastic.
You.
So tell me about the song.
Right. Well, this is a relatively quite an old song. I've recorded it before with.
Okay.
By the way, the version you're going to play is the Dead Man's Corner version one, where it's a slightly different lineup. It's a couple of years old.
Okay.
We had a pedal steel player. We haven't fallen out with these people, but
people just move on.
But the pedal steel player, Alan.
Yep.
Hi, Alan Cook. We're still very good friends, but he said I was making him deaf.
Right.
So he and at that time, I thought, well, I could talk about, you know, about how the band came about. But anyway, The Weatherman.
Yeah.
The Weatherman, for me, was... I wanted to write a song with just two chords.
Okay.
And there's another song we're going to talk about. I wanted to write a song with just one chord.
Right.
Because I was getting accused of, your songs are too bitty, a bit like Squeeze, lots of chord changes, lots of bits going on. So I just had two chords. I've got a guitar.
You've got the guitar in front. First demonstration of the podcast.
An A major and then a D minor, which are two. So, I think I saw something in a newspaper, when I used to read newspapers, something like, I put my trust in the Weatherman or the Weatherman. And it was something, so I kind of nicked it. I used to have a book where I would write phrases down.
Okay.
When I used to read the newspapers, I don't anymore.
Sure.
Does anyone read newspapers?
Definitely not, I don't. It's very depressing.
It's very depressing.
It really is.
And I sussed out that... not the main headlines in newspapers, the sub paragraph headlines in most newspapers are just single words, like atrocious or bombed or something like that. But I found out, this is when I started doing this, first of all, about 15, 20 years ago, that the Daily Telegraph, I think it was the only newspaper that had little phrases, like lost at sea. Or, you know, little sub things. So what I would do every morning, I'd go out and buy the newspaper, not to read it, I hasten to add, but just to go through over
just
breakfast.
A bit of inspiration.
And I'd have a book and just, you know, and write, that's like Souls Unknown, that's good. And I'd just write these stuff down without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And just write whole, and I'd have pages of these little phrases.
Yeah, okay.
And then later on, when I was strumming a guitar, looking at the TV, it's good if you're trying to write songs. What you don't want to do is sit in a room thinking I must write a song. Although this is the point.
Yeah.
Either look at the TV.
Yeah.
Or a girly mag or whatever turns you on. Something that will divert your
I got you.
Your conscious away because it's you know you want to get going to your subconscious.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
And so So The Weatherman. I put my trust in The Weatherman. And then there's kind of a turnaround. This is, I think, why people like this song. These vibrations knock me out. So it's got this kind of hippie thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm a closet hippie, really.
Okay.
And although I told my wife, my lovely wife, jokingly, I'm a bit of a fascist. Not in a fascist, like that sort of way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When she heard my songs, she said, you know, and I'm always knocking Labour and the and socialists.
Okay. Right.
She said, Steve, your lyrics are all about socialism. You are a socialist in my
heart.
It's
in there somewhere.
It's there. She said it's there, saying you're right in the face.
Yeah, yeah,
They're all really about people and how we've got to help each other and
sort of
thing.
Absolutely.
So anyway, for those of you that do play guitar, this song has got, I call it two chords. It's got an A major. Mm-hmm. But within this A major, there's a pedal A.
It's all coming back to me.
Second chord. Yeah, that sort of thing, backwards and forward. And that was it.
Okay.
So, that's how that song came about.
I love it. Okay, that's wonderful.
I was just
going to say, it's interesting hearing your process because I've had, we've done a few episodes of this now, and it's a question I always ask is, what is your sort of process? Because you hear all sorts of things about, as you say, people lock themselves in a room for 8 hours or one of the guys that I had, him was quite interesting, and he said he kind of comes up with a melody and then he just puts nonsense lyrics to it just to kind of make it kind of into something and then he rewrites the lyrics to fit it,
But some people have poets, like we were saying, some people are poets and they write poetry down, or they get lyrics, or they write with... See, writing with somebody else, that is a weird thing. When you sat in a room, I've tried this, and you look at each other and go, let's write a song.
Nothing comes out?
Or in a rehearsal room.
Yeah.
And you can do that, but it's a different kind of song that comes out. And you tend to... For better or worse, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but, being in rehearsal room with a band, let's write a song, you come up with a riff, and then someone goes, why don't we put this, and then maybe there's an idea that you had. And so you can sort of, most songs, no matter what people say, are glued together bits of ideas that you've had.
More
often than not. But I'm not a piano player or keyboard player where everything is laid out in front of you. So it doesn't matter what key you're in and whatever, the fingering is slightly different. But a guitar is quite peculiar in the fact that certain things sound good on the guitar and you're always kind of struggling, not struggling, but trying to find something that's a bit weird or a bit, this is the way I work, or something that's a bit different, something that you want to kind of something like you got a D minor. This is a straight D minor chord, but just twist it a little bit and make it a little twist in it. I like it.
All right, okay, so I think we should give it a listen. Let's get into this. Is the Weatherman.
Fly a final call.
captain here, no, no, no private parts. Some things I'll miss, but I won't know. Trust in the weatherman. I give my faith to the floor. All my trials, Lord, are just elements. I must admit, I'd live some more.
Wonderful. So we're going to get into the second track quite shortly. I just wanted to ask you about Dead Man's Corner and kind of how the project came about. So it was Neil that contacted me originally, which is your drummer.
Yes.
Because Neil had met me previously with another band that he was working with. And
he plays with lots of people.
Yeah. Neil gets about a bit, doesn't he?
But so how did it all come about? I've hooked him. Yeah. Well, hopefully.
Well, he told me he was pretty flattered to audition for the band, is what he told me. And he's delighted to be part of it. So.
Right. Okay, cool. Okay, yeah, the band. Well, I'd had it, you know, with band. I got married. I met my wife 6 years ago.
Okay.
We got married 4 years ago in Whitstable Harbour.
Okay.
At a little corner of Whitstable Harbour called the Deck at Dead Man's Corner.
Ah, nice.
Yes, which is pure coincidence. But it wasn't a legal marriage. It was what we call in the business. It was a Mick Jagger wedding. You know, it was like.
I love it.
Yeah, it wasn't legal.
Right.
So anyway, we got married 4 years to the day in August last year, legally.
Okay.
And now we are legally married. But anyway, that's by the way. So that's right. I'm kind of up to here with bands, you know. So I make a living now really doing solo acoustic gigs.
Okay.
And I deliberately do covers. I don't do my own songs on these gigs. I'm doing covers, but in my head, I've got like about, you know, 200 songs, and they're all from my own personal jukebox, if you like.
Right, okay.
And so I don't have a set list, and I don't know. It's fantastic, you know, because I can go in the middle of a song, I can just go from one song to the other, or cut this short, or twist it around, and
that's
I can even stop and go, I'm sorry, I'm just going to stop now, you know. And it's all part of the charm of my solo gig.
Sure, okay.
And I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
But I was getting to the point And I think it was about 2.5 years ago, I was saying to Louise, you know, I've got to, I really got to form a band. I really miss it. I miss playing loud electric guitar. Mm-hmm. I really do.
Okay.
I mean, I actually hate acoustic guitar.
Do you really?
And I used to joke and say, I hate acoustic guitar that much that I've ended up only playing acoustic guitar. I must have done something really bad in a previous
life. Sounds
like
it, yeah.
Right, so. But anyway, so.
But the electric you brought along last time, the White Falcon, is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything like it. It's unbelievable.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that later. Okay.
So anyway, so I first started doing acoustic gigs probably about 10 years ago. I tried it, and I sat down to play because I thought that's what people that played acoustic guitar did.
Right.
I thought you sat down. And you know, it's like, and then the first gig was, I really hated it. You know, I was somewhere up in Suffolk and did this gig in this pub, and I sat down and I was acutely aware there were people in there that played acoustic guitar and did all the finger style stuff.
Okay.
And I can't do any of that because it never interested me. I never wanted to be an acoustic guitar player.
Sure.
You know, I started off as a rhythm player and I thrash it. So then this big light bulb came on and said, why don't you just play acoustic guitar like you play electric guitar? Just lay into it.
Yeah.
So I now stand up and have a long lead and I go out to the audience and I do that.
Nice, okay.
Dead Man's Corner. Right, so I wanted a three-piece band because I think a three-piece band is great. It's what it does, if you're playing not just blues stuff, but, you know, melodic stuff, it's quite tricky, and everyone in that band has got to carry the song.
Mm.
If it's a blues-based three-piece, like Cream or anything like that, then it's a whole different kettle of fish. But the thing is, guitar, bass, and drums, you see it all the time. You see it in pubs, every band doing it. And I didn't want that. So I said to Louise, I want to form. She said, well, just form a band. I said, but, you know, it's difficult, you know, because I'm making excuses.
Yeah.
And I said, but what I really want, this is what my ideal band, I want me on guitar and vocals and write the songs.
Yep.
And I want, instead of a bass, I don't want any bass guitar, but I want Hammond organ. I don't want a keyboard. I want a real Hammond organ with Leslie's.
Okay.
Another bass build. And playing that Hammond organ, I want an old black guy, an old Jamaican guy with gold teeth and a two-ton suit. Playing that across between Steppenwolf and Jimmy Smith.
Right.
And she's going, yeah, okay, right. Like that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, no one has a Hammond organ these
days. I was going to say, yeah.
They have a keyboard with us, but it's not the same. Because I'm from that era with Hammond organs, you've got the Leslie's swirling around, and it's just like a whole thing.
Yeah.
And on drums, I better watch my language here, I want a big, fat, gothic, how can I put this?
Like a metal band, like real life.
A girl drummer.
Okay, I got you. You
know, but just Larrup the kit.
Yeah.
And she went, right, okay. So I tried this out. I did try it out with a guy, Ben Mills. Do you know Ben Mills?
I do know Ben, yeah.
He's from around here.
Yeah, he's from Broadstairs, nearby.
So he said, I'll come and... he said, I can't play. I'll bring another keyboard. I've got a Vox Continental organ, which is what the Doors use, what the Animals, that old six. I said, great. And we tried the songs with that, and it was great. It sounded fantastic. But Ben said, but there's a problem. He said, I can't commit because I'm so busy.
Yeah, doing a lot of solo stuff.
I go out for a lot of solo stuff doing that. I can't, you know, so. So it kind of went to a back burner. On my birthday, 2.5, 3 years ago, we were in Whitstable Labour Club, and... this guy said to me, he said, I want you to meet Alan. He's from Manchester, so fellow Mancunian.
Yeah.
He was with his wife, and Louise and I were getting a bit drunk. It was my birthday, you know. And he plays pedal steel. He's a professional pedal steel player.
Okay.
So I had a pedal steel, but I didn't know how to play it.
Right.
It's one of the most... Let me tell you about pedal steel.
Please do.
It's used in country and western music, and it's one of the most complicated instruments you can manage. You have to be... it's like brain surgery.
Yeah.
You have to be that clever to play it.
I think, is it kind of like the table with all the strings?
Well, it's like a slide guitar. Basically, you know, slide guitar, but it's down. But it's got these levers, these foot levers and pedals. And when you press them, they pull the strings, tighten them.
Yeah.
So you can actually move, change chords within, you know, just by moving your feet.
Yeah.
But then you have to play it on top. So it's like, It's like flying a helicopter.
Is that much more
difficult than flying an aeroplane?
Is it the chap from Bamboozle, the band Bamboozle? Is that Alan?
No, he knows Alan. We're kind of friends.
I met them at a gig once, Bamboozle, and I watched him play, and it was just baffling. How does his knees doing something and his feet are doing something?
So you know this, and I like to make general sweeping statements. You know when you see a country and western act, and it's. It's, shall we say, it's not pushing music to boundaries, but it's great. We all like, like in any genre, there's good stuff and bad stuff. But the side of the stage or at the back, you've got a pedal steel player, and he is like a brain surgeon with a white coat.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that's the sort of thing. Anyway, so we got chatting, and this thing clicked in my head, and he said, I was living in Whitstable at the time, and he said, yeah, we've just moved down from Manchester because I'd played the sessions at the Oyster thing and everything. I really like it. So I said, you're a pedal steel player? He said, yeah, I play a bit of guitar, you know. And I thought, if I put a pedal steel in an inappropriate situation, so this is my thinking, this is all in like a few milliseconds in my mind. If I put, because the minute people hear a pedal steel, minute you hear that moaning sound, you assume it's country and western music.
Right.
But if I put it in my songs, which is slightly odd, shall we say, I wouldn't say psychedelic because that gives a wrong impression, but they're not quite right. And so if I put that in my music, it would be great.
Bit of a juxtaposition, changes the perceptions. Yeah. I like it.
But then I'm back to the position where I would need a bass player then, because I'm back from a three-piece. You couldn't have a guitar, pedal steel and drums. That would be just, even for me, that would be too strange. Okay. So you would then need a bass player. So I need a bass player. So I started to go around to Alan's house and I would teach him my songs.
Yeah.
And I would look at him. I'd go around the morning and I'd say, well, it goes... So country and western music would go for so long, and then you can assume what's coming next. But I'll go, well, it goes, and it'll go, and then, and he'd have to work all his chords out, and I'd look at him, and when his eyes started to cross and start spinning around, I said, I think we need a cup of tea.
Right,
now we rest it. So we spent weeks going over my songs, and Alan seemed to, I said, are you still into this? He said, yeah, I really love it. These songs are great, you know, so anyway.
Okay.
But on the other side, I needed to find a bass player.
Yeah.
This is where Justin, who you met.
Justin.
He's the one, apart from me, he's the one concert thing that's gone from that version of Dead Man's Crawl to this one.
Okay.
Justin won't mind me saying this, but anyway, so I was at the old Neptune, a bit drunk one night. There's a ska band on. And there was a ska band. You know, whether you like ska music, I'm not saying anything, but it's a ska band. But in the middle of the ska band was this good-looking guy, and he was right in the pocket. And I just noticed that his bass playing was absolutely... And I wasn't looking to poach anybody.
Sure.
That's not what I do. You know, because who am I to poach? I'm nobody. Like, we're all in this together, you know?
Sure, yeah.
But I did know the girl sax player in the band. So what I wanted to do was book a rehearsal room and try the songs out, but I needed a bass player. And I had a drummer, and I had a pedal steel, and I had myself. We had the songs, but... So I phoned up this girl and I said, I won't mention her name, she might be embarrassed. And the conversation went like this. I said, your bass player, she said, you're not trying to nick him, are you?
Straight away.
Right in there. I said, no, I'm not trying to nick him. And then she must have felt good. She said, he does trains. I said, whoa. I said, can we start again?
What does that mean, he does trains?
I don't know. But anyway. Hi, Justin. I'm telling this story. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was the band. That was the band. And at that time, getting back to the songwriting thing.
Yeah.
You know the infamous or the famous or the lost, the basement tapes, Bob Dylan. Do you know about this? Where after Bob had been around the world and got slagged off for going electric and everything, you know, and it was a really intense period of work for Bob in like 1966, Bob Dylan. And so he retreated to Woodstock and they went upstate and they retreated, him and the band, to a basement in a house up there in Woodstock without any outside influences. And they started playing the Great American Songbook, you know, of all stuff, all these songs that, you know, that Johnny Cash has done. Mm. And also a lot of stuff that Dylan had written, but not for anybody else, not even for himself. So And now it's commercially released. It's like a 6-CD box set with books, and it's called The Basement Tape.
Yeah.
So Louisa bought me this.
Okay.
And I thought, this is brilliant. What they've done, they've just put a couple of mics up in a room, like the old blues guys.
Yeah.
They haven't mic'd everything up and done overdubs and everything. They just played. And someone over here, when you get a bunch of people playing at a gig, you don't notice that somebody makes a mistake there and someone makes a mistake, because it's a moment in time and it's gone.
Right.
But when you record it and you play stuff back, then you hear all the mistakes.
Yeah.
And that mistake is there all the time. Every time you play that track back, it's there.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter, because the overall thing was the performance. They might have all been, it sounds like a lot of the stuff, they're stoned. Sorry, Bob, I'm making an assumption. You know, drunk or whatever, or a combination of the two, or maybe not. And they just play. And the stuff like Quinn the Eskimo, that Manfred Mann, lots of, and Wheels on Fire, Rolling Down the Road, which had never been released. But these tapes became bootlegs, and people got them, and they recorded the songs. And did you know that there's nothing to stop anyone recording one of your songs? If someone that I don't like particularly decides to record The Weatherman, say, oh, I can't name anybody, and they do it in like a real popular, I put my trust in the world. And
there's nothing you can do.
There's nothing you can do to stop that.
That's interesting. I remember stories a couple of years ago coming out. This is a bit of a tangent, but the TV show Glee, you know, the kids sort of thing, and they did covers of so many songs in that show. And I think, I'm trying to think of the band now. It'll come to me.
Yeah.
But I remember the band, might have been Kings of Leon or someone, it was a huge band, and they rejected their songs being allowed to be used. They sort of put up a big fuss about it. And I remember other people coming out, so Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters, and I think Elton John as well, they all came out and said, it's ridiculous, what are you doing stopping? This is one of the most popular TV shows, it gets millions of viewers, you should be happy to have your music. But it's interesting you say that.
Didn't Sting, I think, one of his songs was used on an advert that he didn't approve of.
Oh, really?
I mean, I can quite understand. I can't remember the ins and outs of it, but I think he managed to pull it, you know, because, for example, I'm a vegetarian.
Okay.
Now, if McDonald's or somebody wanted to use one of my songs, I would be a bit miffed about it, you know. But there's nothing you can do.
That's
but maybe there is now. I don't know.
Well, no, but I'm not too sure. I was talking to someone recently in my day job. I work with film and TV producers, and a TV producer was talking to me about how there's a list, basically, obviously with the turnaround of TV shows, if you want to use a bit of music, you can't go through all the channels every time and apply every time, because they have to make a show and get it out very quickly. Right. So that every song from every major label is accepted, and there's a list of people who have said they don't want to be a part of this. And I know that it's usually very, very small bands, but I know that Stereophonics are on there for some reason. And there's about eight bands that have said they don't want this.
I'll tell you a story now. You can edit this out if you want. I've got a friend who plays with Manfred Mann. I've known Manfred Mann a long time from South East London and stuff. And Manfred had a hit with Blinded by the Light, didn't he?
Okay.
And that was a Bruce Springsteen song, I believe.
Right.
And then, because that was it, he recorded like about four or five other Bruce Springsteen songs.
Okay.
And in the end, Bruce Springsteen wrote to Manfred saying, will you please not record any more of my songs?
Really?
That's the story I've heard. It may or may not be true, but
you can edit that out.
No. I try and edit as little as possible, Steve.
Keep
the whole thing unfiltered. Okay. But let's get back in, Zoe, because we've gone on a few tangents. Let's go back to the second track we're going to talk about today and about to play. So this is Souls Unknown. So back to Dead Man's Corner and tell me about this one.
Yeah, Souls Unknown. This song, I can tell you, these aren't new songs. This is quite an old song. My old boss, Paul Young, has actually recorded this song.
Okay.
I demoed this song quite a while back in Greenwich, and the Paul Young band, I was in the Paul Young band in the 80s and stuff, and then in the 90s, I think, I was with Paul socially, and I gave him a cassette of this song, Souls Unknown, to have Pino on it, and I never heard anything back. And I was sat in... I actually was signing on the door at one point, and one day my phone rang. I was living in South East London, and it was Paul Young phoning. He said, "Bolts." He said, "Is Paul here?" I said, "Oh, Paul, how are you doing?" He said, "I'm in the studio. I'm doing a new album produced by Don Was, you know, from Was Not Was."
Right.
He said, "You know that tape you gave me? that song? I said, yes, wasn't it? He said, it's fantastic. And Don loves it. And we want to record it for the new album. I said, oh, really? He said, we want you to play on it. He said, so can you come out to LA tomorrow? I said, well, I'm supposed to be signing on tomorrow. I remember that.
Fantastic.
That's exactly what I said.
Really?
We're supposed to be signing on, but I'll see what I can do.
See what I can do, yeah.
So I went out to LA and Don was. And the weird thing, we had like, we had the drummer from, what's that band that did Africa? Toto.
Toto, yeah.
And in fact, it was the last thing he played on was my song.
Oh, wow, okay.
He died in a bizarre gardening accident, but...
What, just after that, yeah?
Just after that.
Wow.
I hope my song didn't...
Oh, bloody hell.
...do it for him,
It's the omen.
Yeah, sure, John.
Yeah.
Sure. So, it was part of this album, and so I thought, great, you know, good, it's on the album. Paul was still with CBS, when it was CBS then. But then I heard that CBS didn't like the song. They thought it was too weird for Paul, you know, with his pop market and everything.
Yeah.
So they sat on it. Last year, 18 months ago, there was Paul Young, the Sony years, a whole collection, like 4 or 5 CD collection of songs. And that's his version of Souls Unknown is on that.
Oh, okay.
So it finally saw the light of day.
Yeah.
But... and the same with the other song we're going to pick, but it's a weird thing. But yeah, so...
that's wonderful.
This song is... I think this might have been another thing I read, you know, Souls Unknown. It's, you know, when a plane crashes or something like that.
Yeah, sub-headline, yeah.
It's Souls Unknown. It's like a weird thing, but it's got this sort of... that's sort of like that...
Yeah.
Eastern sound to it.
Yeah.
But really, this started life just as I think I had a keyboard. I don't play keyboards, and it had an automatic thing where it just went. Like an Eddie Cochran sort of thing. So that's how that song started. And so it's just kind of got this. That's right. When we introduce this song, I always say this is a vampire song.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounds a bit dark. Yeah,
it's a bit dark. Yeah, but
dark,
good.
Yeah.
But it's good because you mentioned the Gretsch, and I've had Gretsches in the past. But Gretsch guitars are fabulous. You know, for anyone that doesn't know, they're big body Stray Cats, Dwayne Eddy. They're using country and western. They're using psychedelia.
Okay.
Steve Stills, but they've got a big resurgence. Actually, do you think it's funny that rockabilly music, which I'm really into, is really strong at the moment?
It really is,
It's like a real resurgence of it.
It really is,
And it seems like people are just sick of the way pop music's gone off and on.
Pop music, absolutely.
So rockabilly is what you hear is what you get.
Yeah.
And there's some great... And tell you what, to be a great rockabilly guitar player... It's like almost jazz-like. You've got to get your chops together.
Yeah,
I'm teaching myself good rock, you know, advanced rockabilly stuff. But anyway, So, so everything I write these days has got this either surfing. You know, that sort of behaviour and. Surf music and rockabilly is kind of really what I listen to a lot of the time now. And the Gretsch guitar makes you play like that.
Yeah.
And so the way we do Souls Unknown now, it's kind of more like that with the trem guitar and the, you know, that voodoo sounding stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a good way to describe it. I like it. All right, well, let's get into this then. So let's play the second track today. This is Souls Unknown.
We'll be right back.
Wonderful. Okay, right then, ladies and gents. So we're back in. So we're going to go into the third track shortly, but there's just too many stories, Steve. There's too many things to talk about. So I want to
say, I must say, people, that go on to www.deadmanscorner.net.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you can get, well, that's the first EP, but our new EP.
New EP is just about out, isn't it? Yeah.
Things I've never thought I'd be saying. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
No, not at all. No, but I want to ask about you, Steve. I want to talk about, obviously, so Atomic Rooster was the, I believe it wasn't your first band, but it was the first sort of big band that you were in that kind of really made it and recorded albums. Is that right?
And there's a revamped version of it now. I've just come back from doing it. It went like this.
Okay.
In my teens, I'm in Manchester, you know, North Manchester, and I'm playing in bands, quite naive. You know, I wasn't doing drugs or anything. I didn't anything, no, nothing like that. But I'm really quite a naive kid, you know. And I was a rhythm guitar player. We had a band, five-piece band, great guitar. A couple of guitar players went through the band in Manchester, who were really great. I mean, like Eric, really great players. I never had any ambition to be a lead guitar player. I started off being a rhythm player, and that's what I wanted to be. So it went like this. We came down to London overnight. Our parents waved us off, and my then-girlfriend got us a house, so we had a house in Hounslow. Usual stuff. The band hit London. The band split up. The rest of the band went back up to Manchester, but I stuck it out, and a friend of mine who was already down in London, so we'll come and stay at our place. And so I think I got a job playing guitar in a strip club in Soho, you know, okay. Starting at 2 o'clock in the morning. But back then, in the New Musical Express and Melody Maker, bands used to advertise on the back pages, even top bands,
really,
with a phone number.
Okay.
I mean, that wouldn't happen now, you know.
No, like, of course. No.
It's like, you know, you wouldn't get like Oasis require that phone Noel on 0201. Yeah, it wouldn't. That wouldn't happen. So I used to get the you know, you could try and get a gig, if you like, by going to the West End on Wednesday and getting the paper a day early. So there was a box advert. Atomic Rooster, who happened to be number one in the charts at that time,
okay.
Atomic Rooster required lead guitar player for upcoming USA tour. So I applied, and I got the job.
Were there others? Was it like an audition?
It was an audition, yeah. So the guy I was living with, sharing a flat with, or his sofa I was sleeping on, he was the lead guitar player, and he said, so he showed me a few licks, you know, okay. Like lead guitar licks, that I really didn't know that many. And I went along, went for two auditions, and all of a sudden I've got this job with Atomic Rooster, and we're off to the States.
Amazing.
1971, 1972, the scene then was kind of still like the 60s. You do a gig, and the whole air was filled with grass smoke, you know, people smoking.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
People at the side of the stage, pressing your joints and stuff. So to me, straight from like green behind the ears, all of a sudden, two US tours back to back, do this, do that. You know, I'm completely experienced, as Jimi Hendrix said. I'm experienced, and that, you know, that's it. So, but 18 months I was in the band, and then I left.
Hmm.
They tried to stop me leaving. They asked me kindly, Vincent Crane, God bless him, well, we don't leave, we like you. Then he tried, well, you know, you are contracted. I said, no, I'm not. And then they tried the black magic thing. Well, you know, you can't leave, can you? I said, don't try that with me. Yeah. Anyway, so I did leave, and but it started a few years back, about 3 or 4. It started to come back, and people were going, Atomic Rooster, da 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 da. And so a couple of years ago, I got a phone call from an agent up north, who said, "I've had this great idea because I've been asked, can I get an Atomic Rooster tribute band?" And so I thought I'd phone you, so I've tracked you down. Do you fancy reforming Atomic Rooster? And I said, well, yeah, I think there's a couple of things here. Vincent Crane is dead,
right.
The main guy,
mm-hmm.
who wrote all this stuff. But I am in contact with his widow. So I phoned her up, and she said, no, that's absolutely fine, Steve. And I phoned up Pete French, who was a singer.
Mm-hmm.
He's still like a rock god, you know, and he's still got the lungs and everything.
Brilliant.
And do it. And we've got a fantastic band, a great organ player, great Adrian Gowtree, bass player, Shug Millage, and Bo Walsh on drums, who are all based up north.
Yeah.
But we don't do that many gigs, which is a bit sad, really. But, you know, we keep going to the agent, well, we're big in Germany, we should be touring.
Yeah.
It would be good, because we need the money.
Sure, sure, yes.
But yeah, we've just come back this weekend. We're from Butlins, you know, these weekends there, and
yeah.
It was a great rock and blues weekend, and we did that gig, and then we played in Chelsea under the bridge, which is under Chelsea football ground.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, a fantastic club. Yeah,
brilliant.
Yeah, that's really
wonderful. I think there's such an appetite now, you know, with look at the resurgence of vinyl music, just for an example of people who are kind of, and I think it's exactly what you just mentioned just a minute ago about people are sick of what's in the charts, you know.
Yeah.
I think you get real music aficionados, some real people that are
really the audience at the London gig were, my wife said that the audience, half of them were young trendy kids, and were really into it. They were really wigging out.
Fantastic.
You know, they were really digging it. And we got a review by this young girl, a Polish girl, I think, everyone gave us great reviews.
Amazing.
Saying this is what it must have been like in the early 70s to be at a gig.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's a great, great thing. You know.
Just going back to when you first kind of got into the band, I mean, that was a huge jump, because you'd played in bands in Manchester, but what we're talking, sort of like pub level, small level?
Yeah, a bit like what I'm doing now. but
I suppose to get that gig in a band, in a position that you weren't kind of used to, I guess, as a lead guitarist.
No, it was a complete shock to me.
And suddenly you're touring all over the world. And then Atomic Rooster supported The Who, is that right? Is that how that kind of link came about?
Well, we did support The Who. I'd actually seen The Who, I had the pleasure of seeing The Who in... When I lived in Manchester, at Manchester UMass, I saw The Who at Manchester University when, just in the audience, about 40 people, and Pete came in, his wife was carrying a Strat, and they just started and played. And it was just, and then I saw them do Tommy at Manchester Free Trade Hall. And then one classic occasion, when I was a mod in North Manchester, we got the word on the street was, The Who are doing a secret gig in Bury, which is another Manchester suburb.
Yeah.
So we got in this guy's van, Bury Palace, it's like a Mecca ballroom. And we went in but it was supposed to be a secret gig. And they were like, in a huge ballroom, about 50 people.
Wow.
Who'd all got the word, you know? And I remember at the time, because I spoke to John Entwistle about this, we were told that Roger Daltrey was in hospital, done too much speed.
Okay.
Right, so they were going to do it as a three-piece. So they started off with Keith, the song that first started off, Keith Moon singing Barbara Ann, and they just went for it. And we were excited. I had my full-length leather coat. When we got there, we looked at the stage. It was a double drum kit, The Who, and the two Marshall stacks here and two Marshall stacks there. One set of Marshall stacks was completely pristine, and the other had big punch holes in the front.
Right.
And that was obviously Pete Townsend's side. So we said, let's stand at this side.
Brilliant.
And even though there were only 50 people in the room, they still smashed the kit. Mooney kicked the drum. They dragged it. Townsend smashed the guitars up and everything.
Oh, wow. You know? That's amazing.
So you've got to think, for me, when I got this call, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
So this was like a bizarre thing. So we scoot forward. After the Paul Young Band.
Yeah.
I'm married. I've got a one-year-old child. I'm living in southeast London. Things aren't going well with my marriage. And I'm kind of heartbroken, to be quite honest. And this one day I got up and I hadn't worked. I ended up being a bit of a session player. But it's like an actor. You sit by the phone waiting for the phone to ring.
Okay.
You don't actually go out there and make stuff happen. You get into this real habit of sat by the phone like actors do. Hello, da-da-da-da. And when it doesn't ring, things go wrong. You haven't got any money, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd had a year where things hadn't gone right. My wife had... We were still under the same roof, but she was sort of having an affair, and it was all a bit wrong. This one morning, I'm cooking some boiled eggs, and I just thought to myself, I said, that's it. I mean, I have nothing to give up. I said, I'm giving up music. I'm not going to do anything again. And the phone rang, and I picked up the phone. This voice went. He said, Bolts. I said, yeah. He said, it's Pete Townsend. Yeah. So which kind of stopped me in my track. This is the whole.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, right. He said, no, don't. He said, it is Pete Townsend. He said, listen, mate. He said, I'm a big fan of yours.
Yeah.
I went, yeah. He said, listen, I've got a question. And this is all like, what? He said, I'm a big fan of yours. I've seen you play with a Paul Young Band many times. And I see in you what's in me, you know, that sort of attitude.
Okay.
And I said, right, okay. He said, I've got a question to ask you. He said, we've got the Who 25th anniversary tour coming up. He said, I've got a hearing problem. I said, pardon?
Hey,
you know what I mean? I said, he said, I'm going to be playing acoustic guitar on this tour. He said, and I want you. I said, you want me to be in the front line of attack? He said, yeah. He said, I want you to do your thing. He said, now there are only two people in the whole world I would trust to do this job. I'm
speechless, to be honest.
I'm speechless. And he said, as you... And Joe Walsh, and you know, and quick as a flash, I said, Joe Walsh is American, isn't he? I said, you can't have a Yank in The Who. It wouldn't be cricket.
Absolutely.
He said, you know, you're right, aren't you?
I like it. Sell yourself.
But I suppose you'd better do an audition, hadn't we? At this point, I got really nervous. He said, can you come over to Eel Pie Studios? Just bring an acoustic guitar.
Okay.
I hate acoustic guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. He said, you know, we'll just have a bit of a play together, you know. I'm drove up. I said, yeah, sure, when? He said, next Wednesday, 8 p.m. at night. I said, right, I'll be there. I put the phone down. I thought, shit, I've been offered a gig to play lead guitar for The Who.
That's unbelievable.
I mean, The Who carry on now, you know, but then, it was, this was like a big deal, 1989. So I drive over there. Pete's there. He goes, yeah, man. And so we sat chatting in the control. He's got a studio there. And he says to his roadie, go and get the Gibson J200. I thought, this is the moment when I've got to play guitar with Pete Townsend. This is where it could go all tits up, right? To be quite honest. So he brings it, and he opens up a vintage J. And as the Pete opens the case of the guitar, it hadn't obviously hadn't been open for so long that the atmosphere and all the strings snapped.
Oh, really?
And they twanged and the bridge flew out.
Oh, God.
And I said, see? I said, the guitar smashes itself rather than let you play.
That's what it is. There we go.
That's what he said. He said, fuck it, you've got the job anyway.
Really?
Yeah, so.
That's amazing.
But then it started, because this was before the internet.
Right.
Right. And I had a convertible Beetle, and we were rehearsing every day in West London. I was given a box of cassettes to learn the stuff.
Yeah.
Now, my Who knowledge sort of finished after Who's Next. Okay. Quadrophenia, you know, but there's a whole bunch of stuff after that I never even heard.
Yeah.
So all the stuff like I Can See for Miles, My Generation, all that stuff. But there's a whole bunch of all this, how can I put it, not classic Who stuff,
yeah.
You know what I mean? So as I'm driving across London every day from South East London to West London, I'm playing this stuff, and we had to learn like 250 songs, you know. One of those was The Whole of Tommy.
Right.
You know, we had to.
Oh my God!
But it's
unbelievable.
It was one of the hardest jobs I've ever had.
I mean, can you imagine how many people might be listening to this and just thinking, imagine getting that phone call from Pete Townsend? You know,
forward to the very first gig we did was in Saratoga Springs, upstate New York, where it was in a ice stadium, I think, just as a trying out thing. You know, this was only like 20,000 people.
Right.
But the rest of the tour, the gigs were in football stadiums, right? And there were 100,000 people. It's tiered up as far as you could see, like that. You'd never.
Wow.
You know, I'd never seen as many people in one place at one time.
That's unbelievable.
And we had two lots of gear. We're leapfrogging right across the country and everything.
Yeah.
And I remember stood next to John Entwistle. He looked at me and I went, he looked at me and said, you're all right. I mean, I wasn't at the back.
Yeah.
I was down there at the front. To me, it was a complete...
oh, my goodness.
It was a weird thing.
I mean, I can't even imagine what it must be like to stand in front of 100,000 people. Wow. All right, well, let's get this back on track to the tracks we're going to talk about. So the next song we're talking about right now is Cuckoo Kurama.
Right, yes.
Tell me about it.
Right. This has also been recorded by Paul Young. This is on his smash hit album, No Parley. Paul Young, a friend of mine, produced that album, Laurie Latham, and apparently the album was all but finished, but they were a song short. I got a phone call saying that they tried a couple of gigs out without a guitar player, piano, paladino, organ, drum, da, 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 but no guitar. Paul played a bit of guitar on a couple of tracks. And this is before they knew that album was going to go monster, you know, which it did, and Wherever I Lay My Hat and Come Back and Stay went mega. But no one knew that because they were just making an album, you see.
Of course.
So I got a phone call. I can't remember who phoned me up, but would I come up and try and audition and see what the guitar sounded like? So I went up there to John Henry's and, you know, I played, did my thing, and Paul came up. He said, yeah, that's great. You're in. Brilliant. I said, great. He said, by the way, he said, we're a song short for the album. Have you got any songs? As I say, I'm not a prolific songwriter, but... Just the night before, somebody lent me a TR-808 drum machine.
Okay.
And I'd set up this groove going, and I played this.
Right.
And I wrote this song, and all the stuff just came for this drum machine.
Okay.
And I just recorded it. And I wrote the song. I swear to God, I wrote the song in 10 minutes.
Brilliant.
Never gave it. And then the next day, Paul said, have you got a song? And I said, here you go. And I thought, what'd I give him that for? It's too bizarre.
Brilliant.
He phoned me up. He said, love it. Let's go and record it.
Wow.
So we recorded it. So all of a sudden, I'm in a band. I've got the singles released, and it goes to number one. And I've got Sony Music gave me, oh, we'll give you 15 grand. We want to publish it on the song. We'll give you 15 grand, which in 1983, 15 grand up front.
Yeah.
So
that's unbelievable,
so it was like, and the rest of the band going, excuse me, this guy comes in. Yeah. I said, sorry, you know. But I still get royalties from that song.
I was going to say, that. So they didn't buy it off you. You still retain the royalties to that? That was
no,
just...
no, I didn't. No, but it's only like a 5-year contract. But now okay, I have, I think, that like EMI collect for me.
Right, I see.
And I get a bit of money.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Not an awful lot, but overall
it's...
not
bad for something you've written in 10 minutes, I suppose. Hey?
But I had this idea with the now... Sorry, Dead Man's Corner is now a 3-piece.
Yep.
No pedal steel. Different drummer, young guy on drums.
Yeah.
And it's great. And using the White Falcon with the 3-piece, using the White Falcons give a big body to the sound. And it's just, I'm so pleased with this version of the band. It's
wonderful.
Fabulous. But yeah, so I said, I've had a great idea. Why don't we try recording Kookaburra?
Yeah.
Now, Kookaburra, the title, people say, what does it mean? I used to take my kids to school in Southeast London, and used to be a washer and cooker, you know, second-hand shop, and it was called Kookaburra.
Okay.
So I thought Kookaburra, and then I heard a John Lennon song, Dream Number 9, I think, because Aya Cuckoo Cuckoo. So I think I married that up with Kookaburra, and it came Cuckoo. It doesn't mean anything.
I love it.
And it's just about a couple in bed. She's gone to sleep every night, and he's, you know, he wants a relationship with his wife, but she's going to that thing where she just gets into bed every night,
right,
fall asleep. It's just simple. Like, it's a simple love. Why don't we, you know, we are lovers of the world
that's
tonight.
It. Yeah, exactly.
And that's all it is, really.
That sounds wonderful. All right, well, let's give this a listen then. This is Kookaburra.
Drive.
Right then, ladies and gents, so we've got one more track to go with Steve Bolton. But what I wanted to talk to you about was, because I was actually reading up today, there's not many guests I've had in that have got their own Wikipedia page. And so I was doing a bit of research today, and it mentioned on there that you played a gig at the Oval, I think, with Atomic Rooster that was 65,000.
Yeah.
And then you've just mentioned playing for The Who in front of 100,000. And obviously it's quite different to the way you play now in front of a smaller audience in the pub and stuff like that. But How do you find that? You know,
right. Well,
put that in perspective.
That's right. I do solo gigs acoustic.
Yeah,
I love that. It's very interactive. You know, I go on. They don't know what's going to happen. Who is this? But especially if I've never played at this pub before, and I have a very long guitar. I go out to the audience, and it's someone said to me that knew me from my other life as a session player playing on big bands, big stages. He said, "This is great, Steve, but don't you miss, you know, playing on big stuff?" And I was actually genuinely shocked. And I went, actually, no, this is better.
Yeah.
This is better. This is really what it's all about, you know.
I mean,
I mean, having said that with the band now, I do want to get the band on another level.
Sure, of course.
Occasionally, don't take this the wrong way, listeners. Occasionally, very, very, very occasionally, I go home and I'll say to Louise, I don't want to play to drunk people anymore.
No, I get you.
No, because, you know, if you play in concert or you play, you know, stuff like proper gigs, people have a drink, but they've come to see the music.
Yeah.
When you play in pubs, the only thing is people are there anyway. Generally speaking, they're there anyway. And, all right, Steve, how's it going? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
But it's very, very occasional at going to that. But, you know,
I've heard numerous stories from people that, you know, it's the dreaded, you know, I've been booked on the same night as the football. And then you've got no chance. You know what I mean?
Oh, no,
You know, and there is this kind of thing, actually.
That happens.
It was a discussion that I had way back in episode 2 with William Redfer, another musician from Manchester.
Right.
He was sort of saying, like, for most people, music is just something that's kind of happening in the background, you know? Mm. And so, you know, if you go into the pub, like you say, that, like personally, me now, doing Seaside Sessions that I have for a year or so and meeting yourself and other musicians, and now I kind of go out specifically to see the music and I really enjoy it. But of course, there is a huge demographic that will just go out to have a pint with their mates. And if there's music on, there's music on, you know, so it is very different. But also, I personally, as a music lover and live music lover, I love that kind of intimacy of a smaller gig, you know, when I find someone that I absolutely adore their music and I can't get enough of it. And, you know,
having said that, I've got a very short attention span with a band. I can, no matter how good a band is, I think about 20 minutes for me.
Really?
But I you know, because that's probably, I'm a musician, I don't, you know.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, I don't know.
Should we get into the last track?
Yes.
The Harbour? So this is the last one we're going to do today.
Right, the Harbour. I mentioned that Louise and I got married, illegally, on the deck at Dead Man's Corner. So I thought I would write a song, you know, celebrating our marriage there. But also, there's quite a story here about, I don't really know Whitstable Harbour.
Yeah.
Everyone goes there, oysters, shipping. But,
right.
But there's a corner of Whitstable Harbour that's actually Dead Man's Corner. And the council or the local thing have built this decking there. That's where we had
A
flash mob wedding where we just got on there and got married by a friend of ours who was a lay preacher, but not really legal, you know.
Sure.
All our friends came and everything. So that's part of the chorus, and our friends were all around us.
Okay.
But I genned up on Dead Man's Corner. I thought it was a great name for a band, so that's why I called it Dead Man's Corner.
Yeah.
Back in the day, in the 1900s, there used to be, I mean, someone's going to correct me on this, I know, but in the Thames Estuary were prison ships, and conditions were so bad on there that prisoners wanted to escape, and they would throw themselves overboard to try and escape the terrible condition of the ship, on the ships. But then would inevitably get washed up, and they'd get washed up in Whitstable Harbour in that particular corner.
There
was quite a history of hoiking dead bodies out. That's why it's called Dead Man's Corner.
Okay, that's interesting.
So the song is like a combination of that. There's a bit of that, the treasures made of gold, meaning people's spirit and everything, but also about us getting married. So it's kind of, I don't like to be too specific in songs. I like it when you left your own. Isn't it great when people are asked, like John Lennon or Bob Dylan, they're asked about, what did you mean in this song? And they go, I don't know.
I was just thinking when you mentioned the previous song, Cuckoo Karama, I wonder how many people have listened to that, because you say Paul Young recorded it.
Yeah.
Millions of people have probably heard that song. Yeah. And I wonder how many people took a specific meaning from it.
And, and they go, no, and they go, no, no, really, really, what did you mean in that song? And they go, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I can say, I can, in retrospect, say what I think it's about, but at the time, sometime, you know, I mean, some people write songs with a specific story.
Sure.
I've always found that quite difficult. The Harbour is one of the most specific songs I've ever written. The rest of the song is the rest of the time it's usually just a bit I don't know,
a little bit loose.
I'm a big fan of Captain Beefheart.
Okay,
and that's completely nonsense to people, but the brain is fabulous. It can make sense out of nonsense. No matter how much you push it to its limits, it will go, I think I know what he means with that.
Yeah.
So
okay. All right, sounds good. All right, so let's get into this then. This is the final track, and then we're going to come back with your five-minute challenge at the end.
Yeah, but can I just say, I don't know when the podcast is going out, but Dead Man's Corner playing at the New Inn in Whitstable on the 3rd of March. It probably won't be out by then.
I think it will be out before. So this will be out. This will be a couple of weeks before that gig. So
right, so the 3rd of March.
So in a couple of weeks' time.
And then we go on our website, deadmanscorner.net.
Yeah, everything's there. When I put this out, I'll put all the links in the description, and I'll put it out there. Okay, we're back shortly. So this is The Harbour.
Let's do it on the harbor, where the ships are far in wonder, brought their treasures made of gold, and laid them out at Dead Man's Corner. When I saw you and your eyeline, it was there and then I fell. This is my destination. You saw I wasn't very well. And our friends were all around us. They came from near and far. Yeah. silhouette on the harbor. Where the ships are far and wonder, brought their treasures made of gold, and laid them out at Dead Man's Corner.
All right then, so we're back with Steve Bolts Bolton 5 minute song challenge. You ready for this, Steve?
I've never written a song this quickly in my life.
Even Cuckoo Karama was 10 minutes.
Yeah, it was 10 minutes. Yeah, okay, right.
All right, the floor's yours. Take it away when you're ready.
Okay, so. Me, how I write a song. I don't know, it's just magic. But we all know there's no such thing, no such thing as magic. All in my mind, all in my mind, I catch it. All in my mind, all in my mind.
Nice. Thank you so much, Steve. I love it. Everyone gets so nervous with the 5 minute song challenge, and every time it happens, I always just
get me awake for 2 days. Look at me.
That's wonderful. Okay, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today. Don't forget, if you like the episode, give us some ratings on the iTunes store, and don't forget, go to deadmanscorner.com. Is it?
.net.
Deadmanscorner.net to see the tours that Steve's going to be doing shortly, and we'll catch you next week.